We are in Boston at the Sheraton. We're at a meeting, which is actually called officially the
One Mind for Research.
One Mind for Research, but the full title is Next Frontier of the Brain Forum, Imagining the Next Decade of Neuroscience Research and Development. There's a 16-page guide here that Steve Hyman's been working on. But I see on the back here that the contributors to the guide, one of whom I spoke to earlier this afternoon, Tom Insel, is director of National Institute of Mental Health, but we have two other directors here. Story Landis, who's director of the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, and Nora Volko, who's director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. This is a big concerted effort. Why now? Why are you guys involved?
Well, I think that one of the issues that extraordinary and has been pointed in the meeting is that the greatest challenge that we have is to understand how the human brain works. And if you think about it, you always say, could you ever be able to do it? Because at the end of the day, we're limited by the capacity of our own brains. But we will be able to do it because we're not limited by one brain, but the ability to integrate the thought process, the expertise of hundreds of neuroscientists working together, and the advances in technology. So it is possible, and we now have the infrastructure that will allow us directly to inquire into how the human brain works, which was something that in the past was sort of part of science fiction. Now it is possible. And what's also very exciting is that many of the medical centers and brain institutes now have access to this technology, which then allows you to inquire the brain by many different perspectives and by looking at the different diseases, not just focusing on addiction or on Parkinson's disease, but the diseases of the brain, of the peripheral system. You can get the different perspectives that will allow you to, at one point, to bring it all together and get a better picture about what is it ultimately that makes us who we are, which is obviously our brain. So I think that that's why now we have the technology, we have the computer infrastructure to do it, we have the advances that have come out of genetics, and we have, I guess, the common will and goal to do it all together.
So in addition to the systems aspects that Nora's been talking about, we also have extraordinary knowledge of how individual nerve cells function, how synapses function. We have catalogs of all the proteins in synapses. So on the one hand, we have the cellular and molecular underpinnings of brain function, coupled with this extraordinary power to see the human brain structure and actually the human brain at work. So melding those two approaches from the cellular and molecular to the systems approaches offers extraordinary opportunities that really we haven't had before.
Now, but as I said again, why now? Is it that the technologies have suddenly given us the drivers that make all of this possible?
I would say that there are extraordinary scientific opportunities, recognition of extraordinary need, and to be honest, someone who, Patrick Kennedy, who is willing to step forward, take this on as a mission, and serve to coordinate and organize the community in a way that I think hasn't been easy to do before. It's very easy for the neuroscience community, ranging from cellular and molecular people like myself to brain function people like Nora. As soon as you start talking about the brain as a whole and brain function, the cellular and molecular people say, I have the answers. And the imaging brain function people tend to say, I have the answers. And there's always a question of whose approach is best. And I think Patrick Kennedy has done a very good job of making it clear that the opportunities are ripe and that the need is extraordinary. And as long as we can hang together as neuroscientists, all looking at one structure of the brain, I think there's a real opportunity for success here.
Yeah, no, and I think that, and I completely agree, and I think that there are other elements that are also relevant, and one of them is we have an example of an extraordinary success of when scientists come together with the decoding of the human genome. And that was possible because actually people got together and says we're going to go at this common goal as opposed to each one of us did do it in separate. And that has been probably the most extraordinary success in science.
Biological science.
But it is, and I would even not hesitate, I think it's probably one of the most important advances that we've done. So we have an example of what we can achieve when we get together. And I also think what Story was mentioning too, it is extraordinarily urgent that we come up with solutions, because what we're seeing right now in terms of what are the big challenges from healthcare, they relate to diseases of the nervous system. So we're speaking about Alzheimer's disease, we're speaking about depression, we're speaking about chronic pain, we're speaking about addiction. In fact, even for medical illnesses, the component of behavior, which is a product of the brain, actually determines a lot of the outcomes. So there is an urgency to try to address this problem. So you have on the one hand, having seen the successes of what we can do when we come together, and the other, an extraordinary urgent problem.
Yeah. One of the presenters yesterday, the colonel from the army, showed the cover of
Colonel Ling.
Colonel Ling showed the cover of Time magazine that was quite recent that said "Understanding Pain."
Right.
It struck me when he put that slide up as somewhat remarkable that pain is not understood.
Very complicated issue, from peripheral nervous system, sensory neurons with particular kinds of receptors on them that are activated either through inflammation or through injury. That information comes into the central nervous system, up to the cortex. We don't understand how that's processed. And I think the biggest question, we can understand acute pain in the sensory processing, but how you take that, how that acute pain in some people but not all people gets transformed into chronic pain, mm-hmm. we don't have a clue about that.
Which is very unfortunate, because when you sort of get marbled, how is it that we cannot understand pain, which is probably the most frequent symptom of a patient coming to see a doctor? We have very poor treatments for chronic pain. We're treating patients that are suffering from chronic pain the same way we were treating them 50 years ago. Our best medication for severe pain are opioid medications.
Right, so I was going to say.
So we haven't really advanced.
This is how you link, I mean.
No, but it is also, I mean.
You've got strokes and pain, and you've got solutions, which is addictive.
Well, no, but they are also extraordinary. They are very good at addressing acute pain.
Yeah.
They are not so effective at addressing chronic pain, because you become rapidly tolerant to these medications. And yet we don't have medications for the treatment of, very few medications for the treatment of chronic pain. Now think about it, what a level of urgency that means. And one of the aspects that makes this even so much more urgent is the recognition that now, as a country in war, we're getting soldiers that are coming back with physical injuries that, if not addressed properly, are likely to result in chronic pain.
Oh, and there were some heartrending presentations there of what was happening to people and how they came back with the post-traumatic stress disorder and so on and so forth. I mean, Colonel Ling's talk particularly. But one has to assume that that's just a small fraction of the pain that's out there. I mean,
one interesting question is, we assume that the transition from acute to chronic pain is due to the same kinds of mechanisms of plasticity that enable us to learn and to learn motor learning and to remember things. But no one's been able yet to take the cellular mechanisms that we understand so well in hippocampal slices for learning and memory, and to translate those into the kinds of rewiring changes, either biochemical or actual circuit rewiring that almost certainly has to occur when an acute injury is transformed, the pain from an acute injury is transformed into chronic pain. And one of the challenges that I think we'll see in this one mind for research is how do you get people from different disciplines of neuroscience to actually work together and adopt and adapt the technologies and principles that are present in a different kind of neuroscience. So people who work on pain tend to be a guild and to not have moved out and adapted, not all of them. Many of them are now becoming better at adapting imaging and new technologies. But you need to get the pain people to talk to the learning and memory people, to talk to the genetics people, to make the best use of the tools that are available.
And what Story is saying, I think it's actually fundamental, because what has happened in pain, we've addressed the notion of treating chronic pain as if it were acute pain times 3 months or 30 days or 90 days. So the molecular targets are presumed to be the same. And what Story is saying, well, we have neuroplasticity. So those are going to be very different molecular targets. So let's change the table, and as opposed to just addressing it as an insult, and I'm going to deal with that pain as an insult, let's address targets that interfere with those neuroplastic changes, which again brings forward why it's so important to come together. In addiction, one of the areas we have focused most of our effort is on the neuroplastic changes that are associated with addictions. Your brain learns, it's a memory change that leads you to get conditioned to the drug. So in many ways, you could see as chronic pain as a conditioning to that response. It's a learned response. So what we have learned from addiction can then be transferred to animal models, and the molecules that have been used can be used to manipulate them. And that's the beauty of about this concept of one mind, because it's not about the turf of addiction. There's one nervous system.
So if you could figure out how to block addiction, the learning involved in addiction, those same strategies could almost certainly be applied to blocking the transition from acute to chronic pain, interfering with the plastic mechanisms that rewire the nervous system to give you addiction or chronic pain should be very similar.
Correct. I mean, and as you look at it and the presentations, where there's obviously the glutamate system involved in these neuroplastic changes, the NMDA, the AMPA receptors, those are exactly the targets that we're going off after addiction. And so as Story is saying, it's going to be dependent, these different circuits, but the synaptic strengthening are basically produced the same way.
Right, but I mean, is there a general, I mean, gosh, when I was in college myself, Ron Melzack, Pat Wall, there was a theory of pain, right? Has there been a solution since then? Do we really have a story that...
A solution for pain?
Yeah.
Or a better understanding
of pain? A better understanding than Melzack and Wall from 20 years ago, or whatever it is, 30 years ago.
30 or more. That was a hypothesis about gating and circuits. So we know so much more about the pathways of how pain is sensed and how the different parts of the circuit are activated or not activated. I think a modern day graduate student working on a pain thesis would come up with a much more sophisticated and realistic idea of pain.
The reason I said that is that there was a meeting recently at UCSD on pain, and I asked somebody precisely that question, and they said, well, we don't really know a lot more since.
I don't think that's true at all. Nihilism, scientific nihilism.
Okay. No, but you know, and it's not a trivial distinction, because, for example, what Story is saying is we now recognize that the circuitry of pain is much more extensive than what initially it was thought about. Mm-hmm. And by knowing, for example, which are the areas and the circuits that may be regulating emotional reactions of pain, investigators already, like the SHARMs, are using this information right. to teach the brain, to teach the individual how to regulate those areas of the brain and control the emotional reaction to pain by biofeedback that is actually brought back by seeing exactly your brain in vivo as it's responding to whatever you are doing to try to control the pain. So that knowledge is now being applied to try to figure out ways that can help people overcome the negative adverse effects of pain on them. So we've learned, but not as fast as we could, and certainly not at the level that we should have by now vis-a-vis the impact of the problem.
Yeah. So what are the trends at this point? I mean, from your perspective, Story, your neurological disorders and stroke, right. and your perspective from addiction, I mean, what are the trends? Are the numbers going up, going down? I mean, what kind of
the prevalence of those? Yes. So if you look at stroke, death due to stroke has decreased 70% over the last 30 years, largely due not to wonderful advances in neurology, but due to better control of risk factors, hypertension, cholesterol, smoking, exercise, whole variety of lifestyle changes. If I were to say another contributor is that we now have an acute treatment for stroke. So if you get to the hospital within 3 hours and you have an ischemic stroke and the hospital you go to actually has an acute stroke program, you have a 30% chance of walking out of that hospital with no sequelae at all. This was the result of an NINDS trial that was completed in 95, and actually the FDA approved the treatment in 96. So there's stroke prevention has improved, and also we have better treatments for stroke. Now, the problem in stroke and many of the neurological disorders is we don't have very good neuroprotective strategies. So in stroke, we can get the blood flow going again, but the cells which were affected by the absence of blood flow, we don't have any way to rescue them, and we don't have any way to rescue the neurons at risk in Parkinson's or in Alzheimer's or in Huntington's disease or in ALS. So we've come a long way for stroke, but we're now at a point where the same issue of neuroprotection is a significant roadblock for not only stroke, but all the neurodegenerative disorders.
So some of the other folks I spoke to today, I mean Tom Insel, for example, was very much talking about the importance of development, neurodevelopment.
Yes. Yes.
So that you're not...
For psychiatric diseases.
Yes. So that you're not ending up with these
right.
sequelae.
Right.
Is there more connection between the agencies that are dealing with these various things? I mean...
We do,
because we talked about Jay Geed and the emotional brain and so on and so forth, the teenage brain, and
we do. We have a project that is part of the Brain Blueprint that actually goes prospectively imaging our children and adolescents to try to understand much better how the brain develops. And that started initially as a structural, trying to understand the structures and how that they finally get the shape they are. And then it has been, as methodologies have improved, going into the ability to look at the connections by diffusion tensor imaging, and now with looking at connections with resting functional connectivity. So it is extraordinarily important, and for us in the whole field of addiction is crucial, because it is in adolescence, it's the adolescent that has the highest risk for engaging in risky behaviors. And those risky behaviors include taking drugs. And one of the paradigms that is paradoxical is that adolescents are at their peak of their physical health, and you see an increase in risk for dying, and that increase that you see from childhood into adolescence is due to these changes that are associated with these risky behaviors that in fact are part of your normal physiology. As you get into adolescence, your brain, particularly the frontal cortex that normally regulates and allows you to make decisions, is it good or not, is not fully developed. That has an advantage because it's in your best interest to engage into environments where you will get the skills that will allow you as an adult to navigate complex social systems. But that entails a risk. So it is at that stage where adolescents get engaged with drugs, and it's at that stage, and actually very important, to the earlier that they start taking those drugs, whether it's alcohol or nicotine or cocaine, the greater the vulnerability that they become addicted. And also it is at that stage that you also start to see the emergence of several of the psychiatric disorders. So you have an extraordinary important window of opportunity where prevention can make a big difference on someone going into developing a psychiatric disease, including addiction, or not. So it's extraordinarily important, and it doesn't make, for me, as an agency doing drug addiction, it is not that different inquire from that that the NIMH may make as an agency to look at mental illness. That developing brain, you want a healthy developing brain, yeah, because if it doesn't go, it doesn't go. And it's so relevant that right now, if you ask me, Nora, because we're investing a lot of resources in trying to understand what makes you more vulnerable to addiction, I can tell you, mental illness. Mental disorders are actually what puts you at greater risk for substance use disorder if you're an adolescent. So it's the best predictor that you have. So you know, to separate it and says, well, this goes for this or that, it just makes no sense. That's not the way that these developmental disorders appear. They are frequently comorbid.
So I think one of the themes that Tom has been developing in NIMH is the notion that by the time you can actually, most mental illness gets diagnosed, it's 10 or 15 years before the initial beginnings of that. And that's a very common theme for neurological disorders that involve neurodegeneration. We heard today that for Alzheimer's disease, by the time you've got mild cognitive impairment, and actually the spouse recognizes that there are issues, you've already had metabolic changes, biochemical changes in the brain for a period of 10 years. By the time someone is diagnosed with Parkinson's because they have a tremor, that person's probably already lost 60, 70, maybe 80% of their dopamine neurons. So there's the same need to move earlier, much earlier, yeah, to be able to diagnose and then to intervene before the disease is full blown and clinically diagnosed.
So is this meeting basically saying, was Patrick basically saying in the talk that he just, Patrick Kennedy, in the talk that he just gave, when he makes the analogy of the moonshot, this is the 50th anniversary of the moonshot, is he basically saying, from your perspective, and you know, as I said, lots of National Institutes folks here, we actually know, but have not yet implemented a great deal, and we need to get together and do it in some sort of coherent, associative fashion. Is that the
He's saying several things, and that's one of them, which is we need to integrate the efforts and avoid a redundancy when it's not helpful, because as you heard, there was this discussion of whether you should have programs going in parallel, and Story very clearly said, we need, competition is good, you need more than one approach. But he's also saying these are diseases that we have been ignoring and we need to change that. So he's trying to garner the public will, yeah, to do the amount of investment and effort that's necessary. He's also saying this is not something that can be done just by the government. It requires the partnership with private company. It requires the investment of individuals. This is an effort that has to bring America together. In a way, that's what he's saying. So he's saying all of these three things, and he's also saying, through the platform, at the same time, it is urgent, and he's highlighting that urgency with the soldiers returning from war. Yeah.
Right. So one question, yeah, is, do we know enough to actually be able to formulate strategies for cures for mental illness, addiction, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. The scientific community often feels uncomfortable. The neuroscience community feels uncomfortable with the notion that, okay, now we're going to have a moonshot because moonshot was engineering. The human genome, in a lot of ways, was engineering.
And the human brain is rather the most complex organism in the universe.
And you know, the flip side of that is, if you wait till we know enough, many people will have not had the benefit of what could have happened if we had just forged ahead and made the commitment.
But and the other thing that's very interesting about the human genome, I just want to say it's an issue of
engineering.
It was engineering. But it is that concept. No. In a way, it was a simpler because you knew. But they did not have an idea because I was not involved at all with the human genome. I wish I had, but it's not. It's an extraordinary project. They did not have an idea of the complexity that they were going to encounter. So they said, okay, it's going to be these genes. They didn't even know how many genes. They were thinking, well, they're sold. Then they found all of these things that they couldn't explain. That was garbage. So they have absolutely no idea of the complexity that they were undergoing. So in many ways, you start to develop the technology and the knowledge as you start to walk the road of that discovery. And that's why I wouldn't shy by the fact that we don't have all of the, of course we don't have all of the answers. We know that we're going into an extraordinary complex system. But complex systems, if you know how nature develops them by creating out of simple models that get integrated into mm-hmm. networks. And so you generate complexity out of simple relationships that then form into networks that are increasingly more interactive with one another, and the complexity emerges. So it's an emerging property. So I think that we can tackle it.
But if you think it was ACGT, ACGT, and the challenge was to have enough sequencing ability to do it in a reasonable amount of time. Now, by putting the money on the table and saying we're going to do this, that drove the technology. So what was it, the first genome was 400 million, and now we're going to be able to do one for, I heard 5,000 now, and coming to be 1,000. So the desire to do it drove the technology in a way that.
It's a simpler road, but also we have had victories, and that makes you be bolder on the one hand, and it's several years later, and computers, the ability of garnering huge amounts of data sets has increased. We've gone into the open access movements that they didn't have, and that opens it up for the creativity of a lot of people by making this data available, which was not something that was there. And the ADNI project is a beautiful example, right? And it wasn't costly. They just made all of this information, well, it wasn't relatively costly, available. And so people out there that had never had their hands on imaging data, all of a sudden could play and come up with creative ways of analyzing it.
Right. And shared. So the basic principle for the ADNI project was, as soon as you collect the data, it goes up on a website, and thousands of papers have been published on the data that have been up on that website. And sets a very high standard for any kind of project like that other institutes would think. We are thinking about a Parkinson's biomarker project, and I have to say the complexity of guaranteeing that the data go up. Someone goes into an MRI and the next day the data from that person are up on the website for everybody to see and look at and analyze.
One of the things that it came clear in my brain by being in this meeting, what do you extract out of a meeting like this one? Apart from the fact that I enjoy it thoroughly. It became clear, one of the things that Story and I have been discussing as part of the Brain Blueprint is the notion of we in the imaging science have lagged behind in the genome vis-a-vis the open access movement. So we've been discussing how do we change the culture to incentivize researchers to put their images out there for people to be able to integrate it and create large databases. it became clear in my mind, this is something that we need to do. I mean, we had already created a committee. I sort of said,
but we don't have the money.
But we need to incentivize. So that is the issue. And that's where it came clear in my brain. We in the NIH can change that culture just like they did it in the genome. You want a grant, you have to have a plan of putting that data in a way that will be accessible for others. So that's how the human genome made it possible for people to share their data. And I think that is clear-cut one of the things that this meeting had more than anything. I had already gone into that path, but it clarified. If I had any doubts, I don't have any more.
Except that, from what you were saying before, I mean, the meeting was all about cooperation. You were saying that competitive is also important, and certainly Craig and Francis Collins were not cooperating.
No, that's true. The competition was good. It drove each of them to go faster. So a problem is, how do you know when you have the right strategy to pursue? So there was a discussion this afternoon about how you enable people to move prosthetic arms with cortical neuronal activity.
Right.
And there was a discussion about, well, we have John Smith doing this and Bob Brown doing that. Why are we having two people pursuing essentially parallel projects? Well, it turns out when you look at the details of the projects, they're not identical at all. They're not parallel. They're different strategies being used. And we don't know yet which is the more fruitful strategy. So if you said you can only have one strategy going forward, then you have to choose between the two. And if you choose wrong, you could spend a lot of money and a lot of years barking up the wrong tree. And people argue for Alzheimer's that the focus on amyloid and tau is a gamble. Right. We don't know yet that people have bet.
A couple of papers came out recently that were...
But in this case too, I mean, making this data available, integrating, it's not stifling competition, because it's going to be the most creative people, the ones that are going to be able to develop the analytical tools to extract that information in different ways. So you're just increasing the number of people that can actually compete in order to generate knowledge.
Yeah. Do you actually talk to each other? Do you
much? Absolutely. Nora's always trying to sell me something.
Yes, is that true? No. I mean, but no, that's not true. I try to actually, you also try to sell me things.
Of course.
So, but I wouldn't call it selling. We're trying to inspire each other, put it that way.
Okay. Let me ask you a specific addiction question as a case study. Suppose you have a researcher at UCLA, and his name is Charlie Grobe, and he thinks that MDMA is useful in treating PTSD. But we know that that's on the list with cocaine and all the other drugs. How do you make those kind of decisions about who to license and
who to fund?
What constitutes a dangerous addictive substance and so on and so forth?
Well, those decisions are based on the science. I mean, we fund science in order to be able to give us the data that would tell us which drugs are more or less addictive, which drugs are more or less toxic, which drugs may have therapeutic opportunities that we should look into. And I think that, for example, a perfect example is opioids. Opioids are extraordinary painkillers, and heroin is an extraordinary addictive drug. The same thing with the whole area of nicotine. For example, nicotine is an addictive substance, yet nicotine itself may have therapeutic applications, including that of being an analgesic, but it may also have cognitive enhancing effects. So we guide ourselves based on the data. Now, when you come up and say, well, we have this drug that may have a potential for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder, then that particular application will be reviewed by a panel of experts. Then based on the merit, they will give it a score. And if the score is good and high enough and competitive, and this is an area that is deemed of relevance, it will get funded. But there, we have these review panels, and then we have council also, each one of our institutes, that based on the review and the scores that those grants get, give us a recommendation of go or no go.
Yeah.
So the complexity is, could you do some medicinal chemistry that would segregate out the addictive property of the potential treatment from the piece that makes it efficacious?
Which is, for example, right now, an incredibly capturing the attention with marijuana. The notion of medicinal marijuana. Cannabinoids are extraordinary compounds, and our brain is loaded with cannabinoid receptors. And so cannabinoids are involved in a wide variety of functions, including, again, pain, including memory and learning. Right. So it's not surprising that we're seeing potential applications. The issue is that you could, just like what Story was saying, you can extract the active ingredients that are responsible for that therapeutic benefit, optimize the delivery system in such a way that you minimize the side effects, including those of addiction. Yeah. And that's what research is all about. Take advantage of nature, extract that information, and make it better.
Let me ask you a question. Do you recall how you first, and I ask all people this, I'm not singling you out here. Do you remember how you actually got interested in science in the first place? Was it a book, a teacher, was it parents?
I was a high school teacher.
High school teacher for you?
My senior year in high school, I had a just spectacular woman biology teacher who was recently graduated from college and just made it incredibly interesting.
Well, my father is a chemist, and he had his laboratory in the house, and he liked to come up with new synthesis. So since I grew up as a little girl, I was fascinated by chemistry and by numbers. So I cannot remember, because I've always lived surrounded by laboratories. Yeah. And then when I went to, I always wanted to go, and I always actually also knew that I wanted to go to the human brain. So that's how I ended up in medical school. Yeah. Because to me, I like complex things. Things that are very simple bore me. So as complex as it gets, I got into the brain, and that's actually as complex as it gets. I got into psychiatry. Yeah. So I think I'm sort of like, was it a choice or was, because I didn't see anything else. I was brought up in a family where my father was science, and I admire my father, so.
Yeah. So you never considered any other careers then, obviously, not you. I mean, you're not frustrated writers or anything. I mean,
I can remember in college taking science courses and being very interested. I think the final hook was, as a senior in college, I did an undergraduate thesis and was assigned a project by my advisor, who was convinced that she knew the answer. And as the project evolved, it became pretty clear that she didn't know the answer and that her expectation of the way the experiment would come out was wrong. So being able to prove a professor wrong was actually quite intoxicating, and was the final commitment to doing science.
Yeah. But you know, I do it, and I have to confess, I did have, and it generated a tremendous amount of anxiety in my father, because at one point in my life, I love art. Yeah. And I actually love the ability that you have to communicate through images. So at one point, I wanted to do movie director, and I got actually a scholarship to go to Russia. My father stopped speaking to me. He was absolutely outraged and says, Nomra, number one, you're not going into science, and number two, you're going into Russia, which of course for us is terra incognita, because we've been persecuted in Russia. So I did, and I struggled with that decision.
So which is why you do neuroimaging, where you communicate the results.
Extremely important. Visual. It's visual. Right. It's visual. It's actually.
Well, you have some art background. I mean.
and I paint. I mean, I used to paint when I was not director of NIDA, because now I have no time for anything.
Except doing research.
Well, no, but that's the idea. I do research, and I do this job for NIDA, but I have time for nothing else. So I used to paint, I stop it completely. But I'm very visual, and to me it has always been fascinating to understand how we can comprehend very complex data when it's visually presented, as opposed to when you presented it in language form, and through videos. That's one of the reasons why they are so powerful in making a statement.
So, can I ask you two quick questions here from your this notion of the NIH blueprint for neuroscience
right.
research,
right.
point one, and point two, the NIH Stem Cell Task Force. We actually co-chair and originate, the first meeting of the Science Network was in fact a month before Proposition 71, and we did a whole stem cell meeting, and we do the stem cell meeting on the Mesa every year, so we follow this very, very closely, and I'm very interested in your take on stem cell research and where that fits into your agency, but also this also.
So the blueprint, yeah. So NIH spends $5 billion across all the different institutes on neuroscience research. It's almost as much as gets spent on cancer. What's different is that there is a cancer institute, which funds most of the cancer research. But for neurosciences, there's a mental health institute, a neurology institute, a drug abuse institute, alcoholism and alcohol abuse, aging institute.
But what about Francis's new translational institute as well?
Well, so that's not, it'll do some neuroscience. But there are seven major institutes which spend half their budget or more on neuroscience. And while we worked together, I think, reasonably well, the creation of the blueprint has given us a forum. Once a month, all the Neuroscience Institute directors sit down and talk about what's the most interesting thing to do. We all put money into a central kitty, and then we argue about what's the best way to spend that. And there's a wide divergence of opinion, a lot of interest in molecular, a lot of interest in tools and imaging. So it's actually turned out to be a very good way to increase communication, do joint projects, and actually be much more effective at pushing the neurosciences
and
forward.
And actually, the one that's very exciting is the one on medication, creating infrastructure that will facilitate the development of medications for neurosciences.
Grand challenge in neurotherapeutics.
You're both directors, so I asked Tom this question as well. I ask everybody this question. Just to get some sense, we have a whole series of this, the answers to this, that when he came into office, President Obama said that his administration would seek to restore science to its rightful place. No coordinates given. What is the rightful place of science, in your view?
If we go back to your question on the Stem Cell Task Force, one of the things that President Obama did was to produce an executive order which asked NIH to come up with guidelines for what stem cell lines could be eligible
yes.
for federal funding.
Yes.
The Bush policy had as a very important determinant whether or not the stem cell line had been generated before August 9th, 2001 at 9 p.m.
Right.
What
right.
President Obama did was to say, we're not interested in the specific time at which the line was generated, but whether or not appropriate ethical constructs were in place for the donation of the embryo. And I think that was a very significant change in creating reasonable determination for what stem cell lines would be available.
So would the translation be there that you think, I don't want to put words in your mouth, that the rightful place of science is providing the best factual advice that could possibly inform policy?
But you know, I would put, where is the rightful place of science? I mean, we're going back and forth on that terrible economic situation that we're going through. The rightful place of getting out of the economic crisis that we have is investment in science.
Yeah.
Science generates technology, generates solutions. And so as a country, I would put science as a priority, because if we don't, then this gap we have currently in the budget will grow bigger and bigger. We will become more and more dependent in the countries that do invest in science at the level that one should be investing at. So that's where I would put it.
I absolutely agree.
Yeah. Now,
but there's tension. Tension between the economy and the deficit and the opportunity that investment in science presents to this country.
I think of the Science Network as being a sort of an agora, public square. Even another phrase I use sometimes is a conceptual quilt, because the all these things are linked together, so that we have the Glenn Foundation funding programming about diet, nutrition, metabolism, aging. We have stem cell work. We have the science of educating. We do some stuff on sleep. All of these things linked together. And particularly the notion of, during education, what kind of a diet a child is getting, whether they can become addicted to learning in a kind of allostatic Bruce McEwen kind of sense. All of these things seem to me to fit together. Do you see where I'm going?
Yeah, no, I see what you're going. And actually, I didn't think of the concept about how neuroscience can help us improve on education of children and adolescents until, I must confess, 2.5 years ago. And then I learned that the Society of Neuroscience had already created a group that was specifically addressing how can we take advantage of the discoveries from neuroscience to inform on education. So in the field that I work with, which is obviously understanding the brain of adolescents in a way that we can deliver prevention messages that will make an impact in their brains in order to guide them towards behaviors that are not risky and not drug taking. So that is a challenge. We need to take into account all, obviously, technologies that we have to extract information that could guide us what may be the best way of, for example, pass that message into an adolescent. But it's the same question that pertains as a teacher. How do you convey information to a student in a way that's salient for them, so you capture their attention and you inspire them? Yeah. Because that's what you want to do with education, inspiring young people. To get them excited so that they go and motivated to learn.
All right. So what's your advice to a young scientist?
A young scientist? Well, already the young scientist is already on the field. And I think it's an extraordinary field.
But what do you tell them? I mean, Peter Medawar wrote a book about this.
I will tell them that it's an extraordinary adventure to be a scientist. It's a privilege. You are being paid to actually think, to use your brain, to inquire, to discover.
So, and to do something different.
And to help. That can help.
Right. So I would say the most important thing is to be persistent. It's not an easy profession. You have to be willing to do the experiment several times again. You have to be willing to rewrite the grant. You have to be willing
to fail.
And to pick yourself up and do it again. But it is incredibly rewarding. I have a friend who was a lawyer, and she said, the amazing thing about what you do is that every day you have the opportunity to create something. Lawyers don't create, but a scientist can create new knowledge, can for the first time see something that no one has seen before, can put facts together to create a new hypothesis, which then can be tested. It is an extraordinary privilege.
And that can eventually help someone else. So to me, that's what's so extraordinary, that you can contribute in a way that will be beneficial to others.
Which is the whole message from this One Mind forum that we've participated in.
One of the things that I found in talking to students is that they often have no context. They don't know much history of science. So I formulated a question which I like to ask of people who are, you know, advanced in their professions and senior, which is, if who do you think was important? Who would you love to have met in your own fields? If I gave you a time travel token and said you can bring this person to dinner and have a conversation with them, who would you like to speak to?
Actually, it's not in my field, but immediately, Albert Einstein.
Really? But you were at Brookhaven, though, weren't you?
Yeah, I was at Brookhaven. All of my profession
still is at Brookhaven.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, and remember, one of the things that Albert Einstein would do was these experiments in his brain. So he used his brain to transform reality in a way that would allow him to get answers, to look at the parameters. And it's really extraordinary, the insights that he had working really without a laboratory. So that's why that's why immediately I say I would love to have a dinner. I mean, I would love just to meet Albert Einstein.
So I would pick Ramon y Cajal, not because I think would have been interesting to have dinner with him. Might have been complicated, but the ability he had to take static images from Golgi stains and to create a vision of how the nervous system cells and neurons are actually wired together to create all the things that the nervous system does.
He also wrote Advice to a Young Investigator,
he did the same sort of thing.
Final question, thank you so much for this conversation. Final question, what are you optimistic about?
I'm optimistic about many things. I'm most optimistic about science. I don't stop to marvel about what we've done with the web, the complexity of the social networks that we generated, and our ability to harness them in order to create knowledge. And that's why I say this is the time to take projects that are large, because it's that ability of communication that I think is the tipping point. So I'm optimistic about it. And I'm optimistic also about the knowledge that has been given to us as we start to really explore the human genome. I mean, it's giving us the opportunity of looking at proteins that otherwise we would have never addressed. And there's something that Francis Collins says that always captivates my mind. We have the opportunity at looking at the integrated, at the whole, as opposed to just looking at a fragment. And of that, that's why I'm so excited about it.
So for me, it's the extraordinary rate of change in the tools that are available for neuroscientists to do experiments. We heard some examples during this meeting of being able to turn on or off neurons in a particular circuit in an experimental animal, mm-hmm. and see what role that neuron plays. We are able to construct, when I did my thesis work, I worked on naturally occurring mutations in mice.
Yes.
Now you can construct a mouse that has a deletion or addition you order up the mouse you want for the kinds of experiments. You can image the human brain in action or resting state. Incredibly interesting stuff. And so the tools we have available, the rate at which things are changing, the questions we can ask, makes me extraordinarily optimistic about what the next 10 years will show us in neurosciences.
Well, thank you very much for the conversation. It's a delight to see two directors of national institutes who are both female, incidentally.
There are a number of us.
There are a number of you, but I've been asking this question a lot around there.
And but there are not many, though.
No, it's still
very few. We're still the minority.
Still seems to be an issue.
And I love that presentation of the Prader-Willi syndrome that shows when you inherit the genes from the mother versus the father, and the whole prejudice that has always existed on women in science. I thought that was just brilliantly placed.
What was that again?
Catherine Dulac's talk.
I wasn't there for that because I was doing...
It was a spectacular talk, and she actually finished with a comment about there's no reason actually based on the epigenetics to think that women can't do science and math.
Math, and she said, yes, women can do math, and this is the proof of it.
I will have to talk to her.
No, she is actually a very interesting person to speak with.
All right. Well, it was great fun. Story Landis, Nora Volta, thank you very much.
Yep, story.